Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Why is it that J.P. Morgan and the Fed can't think of anything better to do on a Sunday night than figure out how to save Bear Stearns? Last weekend, they had it sold for $2 a share. Not quite enough for some, so yesterday there was a new deal. Still a whole lot of questions, though. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. And by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Monday, the 24th of March. Great to have you with us, as always. Just when everybody had made peace with the idea of the Federal Reserve bailing out a big Wall Street investment bank, they went and changed things on us. Off the top of my head, here are a couple of the questions floating around out there about the new deal for Bear Stearns. If $2 a share wasn't enough, is $10 going to satisfy him? Maybe not. Bear hit almost $14 today, closed at about 11 and a quarter. Question two, is this now officially a bailout with a capital B? And maybe the biggest question of all, why? Marketplace's senior business correspondent Bob Moon's here with the answers. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Kai.
Let's get to the first things first here. Is the federal government on the hook for more money now than in the original deal, lo these 7 days hence?
Well, you know, we were witness to a very delicate ballet when the curtain came up on this new deal this morning. See if you can follow this stretch. The Bear Stearns shareholders get five times as much as they were going to get under the original terms, but the Federal Reserve magically goes on the hook for $1 billion less than the initial deal.
Splitting the difference here. The Fed gets $1 billion back, and Bear Stearns is now somehow worth more money than it was a week ago?
Yeah, we can only speculate about what motivated the Fed to agree to this. Originally, it agreed to provide $30 billion of what they called special financing. That was another way of saying that they would make good on shaky assets from Bear Stearns. Mm-hmm. Well, now the Fed's agreeing to stand behind just $29 billion in Bear Stearns assets. I spoke today to securities law professor John Coffey at Columbia University. He thinks this was the Fed maneuvering for largely political appearances. It's been widely reported the Fed originally dictated the bargain basement price of $2 a share. Well, if that price went up, it needed to get something back in return.
I think that was always the concern of the Federal Reserve, that if any substantial amount was paid to the former shareholders of Bear Stearns, it would look like the U.S. taxpayers were subsidizing a failing company, and that when you failed on Wall Street, the taxpayers bailed you out.
Now, many critics of this deal are saying, hey, take a look at $10 a share. Right. Now it really looks like a bailout deal.
All right, but here's the thing, though. This deal was signed, sealed, and delivered, right? Mm-hmm. Every regulator, the Fed, J.P. Morgan, everybody had bought off on
it. Seemed to be.
Exactly. So what is J.P. Morgan's motivation now for paying more than it offered?
Well, it may have been that the longer shareholders held up this deal, that there was a bigger threat that nervous investors were just going to stop doing business with Bear Stearns or what remains of Bear Stearns, and that could have put us right back in the same crisis. There are also some reports that in the rush to get the deal written up a week ago, that there were some mistakes made in the contract language, and that caused J.P. Morgan to push very hard to get this deal closed. Others say that even adding $8 a share, though, shows what a good deal this was for J.P. Morgan. Again, Professor Coffey at Columbia, he points out they still get the best parts of Bear Stearns at a fire sale price.
They can go through all of Bear Stearns' balance sheet and take the most problem-laden paper, all the subprime loans, and give it at face value to the U.S. government. That means they'll get the assets they want, which is basically the prime brokerage business and maybe the skyscraper, and the rest of it can be largely given to the Federal Reserve as the buyer of last resort.
So what's happening here is that Wall Street held its breath until it turned blue, and now it's getting what it wanted.
Well, that's exactly the concern that some critics of this deal are expressing right now. They say so far the Fed seems to be signaling it's going to do whatever it takes to come to the rescue here. Dean Baker is co-director at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He's very concerned just how far down this road the Fed seems willing to go.
Well, if they don't draw a bottom line, these are sharp people. I mean, the one thing I'll give, you know, J.P. Morgan, all these people, they're business people. They know how to cut a deal. And if they don't think Bernanke is prepared to draw a line, they'll just keep pressing and pressing and pressing. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Why wouldn't they?
And Baker told me he's alarmed that the Fed doesn't seem to be demanding anything for what amounts to taxpayers' money here. Mm-hmm. He suggests extracting some kind of concession here, maybe on limiting executive pay, for example. And he says there's no better time for regulators to be doing that than right now.
Well, we'll see, actually, if that is what happens. Marketplace's Bob Moon. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Kai.
We can sum up that last thing Bob mentioned here in one word. He said it, regulation. As this banking crisis continues to unfold on Wall Street, a lot of fingers are pointing down at Washington and asking what happened to the people who are supposed to keep an eye on the markets. Why didn't they see this coming, and why didn't they stop it? Jeremy Hobson reports now from Washington.
Out of crises come new rules, and Democrats, eager for more regulation on Wall Street, see an opportunity. Here's Senator Charles Schumer speaking on ABC's This Week.
Here we have 30 different regulators dating back from the 40s when the economy was much different. They tell companies different things, and many areas they don't cover at all.
Investment banks, for instance, don't face the same capital requirements as commercial banks. Schumer says if they did, Bear Stearns could have stayed out of trouble. And there's a move in Washington to create greater access to government loans for greater regulation. But not everyone is on board. Former FDIC Chairman William Isaac now consults with banks on how to deal with regulators.
I don't see how you can regulate investment banks and still have them function throughout the world, because the rest of the world's not going to be regulating theirs.
But even Bush administration officials who are wary of tough new regulation recognize the political reality. The Treasury Department is drafting its own plan to overhaul the regulatory system, hoping to head off ideas in Congress. Professor Steve Thiel teaches securities regulation at Fordham Law School.
There's political pressure for regulation and perhaps a hope that the response will only be to streamline and regularize regulation, but not substantially to increase it.
Either way, the fight over what to do starts next week when Congress gets back from Easter break. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
And now from the Marketplace desk of Ain't Life Rich, there is this. Some former executives at the troubled mortgage lender Countrywide have a new project. They're starting a new company to invest in troubled mortgages. The Private National Mortgage Acceptance Company, PennyMac they're calling it. The idea is to buy up whole mortgages from banks at a discount, not the slices of the loans we've all heard so much about. Then they're going to restructure them to make them profitable once again somehow. Ashley Miltite has that story.
Banks with dodgy mortgages on their books can lose a lot of money when homes go into foreclosure. PennyMac gives lenders another option. Stan Kurland is CEO of PennyMac. He says his company will take risky loans off a bank's hands at a discount.
That gives us enough room to reduce the underlying terms of the mortgage in terms of the payment rate or even the amount of principal which is owed on the mortgage.
So that homeowners get to stay in residence while they pay off the loan. PennyMac makes a profit when the borrower pays the mortgage down. Christopher Thornburg of Beacon Economics says restructuring troubled homeowners' debt can be a tricky task, so the banks benefit by outsourcing.
Certainly there is a market that can be met out there.
If one lender chose to adjust its mortgage terms, he says borrowers at other banks would clamor for the same treatment.
This is a circumstance where you really want a third party to be there to make the decision as to who gets the cut and who doesn't.
Getting someone else to make decisions like that could help banks manage their risk without alienating their customers. But which loans will PennyMac buy? CEO Stan Kurland says it will all come down to money.
Assuming that we can acquire the mortgage at the appropriate price, we will work with any borrower who legitimately wants to work through their issues.
PennyMac is still building its staff. Kurland says he expects the company to get into full swing by the beginning of May. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
I'm going to tell you something now, but you have to promise to keep it in perspective, all right? There was good news about the housing market today. Sales of existing homes rose last month after a half a year of declines. Don't believe them, though, if they tell you that this is the bottom. We will have the details when we do the numbers. There's something to be said for taking an actual tour of the colleges your kid might be considering. But as of tomorrow, there will be an easier way. CollegeWeekLive.com is going to unveil the world's largest virtual college fair. Prospective students will be able to chat online with current undergrads. More than 300 admissions counselors will be available there, too. Commentator and high school junior Marissa Brenner says the whole admissions process is this strange game of chicken.
A couple weeks ago, I took the SAT. In another 2 months, it's the advanced placement exams. Every test, every prep course, every aspect of my life is in service of a single overriding question. What else can I do to get into college? And I'm not the only one. High school juniors nationwide are busy marketing themselves to colleges. Our goal? Fine-tune our pitch to our target schools until it fits perfectly on the application. Meanwhile, colleges are busy doing the exact same thing. They send us a seemingly endless stream of marketing materials. Emails, brochures, catalogs, filled with happy pictures of broadly grinning students, because everyone in college is always happy, of course. I even get mail from staunchly Baptist and Methodist schools. The thing is, I'm Jewish. Still, each college insists it's the right school for us. Of course, as we are constantly reminded, just because they want us to apply doesn't mean they're actually going to let us in. The colleges know it too, but that doesn't stop the barrage of pretty promos. Every additional application helps to lower a college's acceptance rate, and more competitive admission stats make a school seem that much better, which, of course, makes us more likely to apply there, because it's more difficult to get into. Seems strange, doesn't it? We're always told that the most important thing is to find the right college for you. Well, yeah, it is important to find the right college. After all, we're going to spend 4 years there, and it could well determine the future course of our life. And so it becomes even more imperative to look beyond the admission stats and the promos and to weigh each school based on its real value to us. So, as I continue my quest for the perfect school, and of course the best possible application to that school, I can take solace in one thing. When the inevitable rejection letters start to pile up, I'll know it wasn't just me who was rejected, but that those colleges, for all their glossy pictures of smiling students, were rejected too.
Marissa Brenner is a high school junior at Los Angeles Center for Enriched Studies. It's a magnet school here in Los Angeles. School us in something. Go to marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Here's a little-known fact about the technology industry. According to the Consumer Electronics Association, women outspend men by more than $14 billion. Some have changed the words tech geek to G-tech for girl tech. Kevin Pereira from G4 is back to talk about some of the gadgets being marketed to women and why that is so. Kevin, good to see you again.
Always a pleasure.
All right, so I think we need to address one thing up front. Is it G-tech for, you know, girl tech, or you've got another word?
Or you could say femtech, and that will keep the fan mail rolling on in, and
keep
the inbox will be full. No, you know, there used to be this mindset that are there girl gadgets? And yes, Kai, there were. As long as they're pink and sparkly and glittery and have puff paint accents, yes, that's a feminine product. And sadly, some manufacturers still act that way in this day and age. However, a large chunk of them are now realizing that women love technology as well, as long as it works and is designed with them in mind a little bit more.
What have you brought then, anyway?
I brought several devices. One is a new camera from Olympus, the FE340. And this thing has a couple cool features. I mean, is it just for women? Of course not. It has features that guys would want in a camera as well.
Right.
You know, it's a 5X optical zoom. It's slim. It's got 18 different scene modes. But it has some other stuff. First of all, some camera manufacturers have actually designed their camera so the autofocus is at arm's length. Why did they do that? Well, women love to gather with their friends, hold the camera out at arm's length, and snap a photo. And as such, they've set the autofocus to be at that length. Now, this is one of the cameras that has a smile detection technology. It analyzes the people in the frame.
Smile.
And when it takes a smile, flash goes off. But what it actually does is snap three photos, you know, so you can get the smile on its way in, hopefully when it's at its fruition, and
so
then on the way out.
It's kind of winging it here.
Right, but you can actually select which photo is best. And so if you are taking a photo at arm's length and you can't even see the screen, just give it a smile.
There we
and
go.
There you go, photo snap.
So this thing, I don't even know what it is. It's small and it opens up.
That is
it,
yes.
And it makes a noise?
Well, Kai, that's a cell phone that has a color screen, so I know you're confused. Have we upgraded yet? Come
no,
on.
No, we haven't. I still hate my cell phone.
All right, well, maybe this one will sway you. This is the wild card. It's for
cool.
Virgin Mobile. It's actually developed by Kyocera. This phone will actually piggyback on the Sprint network here in the States. So if you get it, you're good to go. No contracts. And we're talking a fully functional, again, very slim, very streamlined product with a full QWERTY keyboard. Once
right,
you
yeah.
pop it
I mean,
open.
You open it up, as we do here, and it's got the whole shooting match.
Yeah, again, it's just slim, streamlined, and it has all the functions you'd want.
How much of this, though, is marketing versus actual change in functionality and design?
Sure. For some devices, it's entirely marketing. Marketing is, of course, the message. It's introducing that hot new color and showing women using this technology. And I don't think, I mean, does it work to some extent? Yes, it does. But the other half of it is just it's actual change that occurs. You know, you can market the phone. Like if you look at the wild card phone that you're holding there, or the Olympus, there's nothing screaming, hey, this is a product for women.
No.
It's just simply a streamlined product that's designed with women in mind as well.
Fair enough. Let's go to that last thing. And for the life of me, I do not understand
this,
the Chumby.
This is one of those things that girlfriends don't know they want in the house until the guy brings it home and explains everything it does. The Chumby is essentially a portable beanbag-esque device with a color touchscreen and Wi-Fi internet that you can configure to display whatever type of information you'd like.
How does this fit into the femtech zeitgeist that we have going on here?
Well, product design-wise, I mean, I hesitate to say that it's cute.
That's so funny. That's what I was just going to say.
But it is adorable. And with a name like Chumby. You turn it on, the little Chumby character waves. That may, in fact, be talking down. I don't mean to. I think the way it fits in is that it's a way of organizing your information and your data at a glance where the barrier to entry is minimal. You touch it, it turns on, and you're right there.
It's letters@marketplace.org. Just put Kevin Pereira in the subject line, and we'll make sure he gets all those. We'll make sure he gets all those letters. Kevin Pereira from G4 Television, attack of the show. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, as always.
Coming up, when dreams of America don't match reality.
I thought that is like one of the movies which I have seen, Edward Scissorhands, where they have all the small plots of houses with all lawns and then the parking garage.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials muscled up 1.5% today, 187 points to close at 12,548. The NASDAQ soared 3%, 68 points, closed at 2326. The S&P 500 bounced 1.5%, 20 points to end the day at 1349. Shares of Bear Stearns ran wild on that news of the $10 a share deal. The stock finished, as I mentioned, at 11.25. That's up 88% from Friday's close. Didn't seem to matter that J.P. Morgan is spending more and taking on more of Bear's liabilities. Its stock was up 1.25%. Monsanto had a fruitful harvest today. It sowed a 7.33% gain after a prominent analyst upgraded the seed producer to a buy. Bond prices were sold. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.55%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. And by MassMutual, also the proud sponsor of Retirement Revolution, on PBS on Monday, March 31st at 10 p.m. Eastern. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
from the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, President Bush meets with the King of Bahrain at the White House. The Boston Red Sox and the Oakland Athletics open the Major League season in Tokyo. Red Sox send former Japanese baseball star Daisuke Matsusaka to the mound. And sportscaster Howard Cosell was born on March 25, 1918. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. China has had its first official Olympic public relations problem. The torch was lit in Greece today, but the ceremony was far from what Beijing was hoping for. Tibetans protesting the Chinese crackdown stole the show. At one point, a Tibetan woman covered in fake blood blocked the road. It's not likely anybody in China is going to be able to read about the protests online. Beijing routinely blocks internet content. Today, it's what the government doesn't censor that has human rights activists accusing American companies of complicity in abuses. Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
China Yahoo's homepage featured a wanted poster with photos of Tibetans accused of starting riots. It also ran the Chinese government's reward for information. Yahoo's been under fire in the past for helping Chinese authorities go after human rights activists. Google, Microsoft, and Cisco have also been accused of helping the Chinese government tamp down dissent. Sophie Richardson is the Asia Advocacy Director at Human Rights Watch.
The individual companies feel if they don't comply and don't do all they can to satisfy the government's real or perceived demands, that they're going to lose out to their competitors. And so what we've seen is that they sort of progressively undercut each other in terms of what they were willing to do to try to get that favor.
Richardson says U.S. companies should use their economic muscle to take a stand. But tech industry analyst Rob Enderle points out that foreign governments have the right to dictate business practices in their countries, and there's not much companies can do.
I'm not convinced they really have a choice.
Enderle says deciding policy isn't the place of corporations. It's a government issue, and the State Department needs to step up. Until then, he says, companies are not in a good position to challenge the Chinese government.
Right now, the opportunity that China represents exceeds the pain that can be caused by adhering to the Chinese rules and regulations. And right now, Yahoo in particular is fighting for its life.
The pictures have been taken down, and Yahoo says it's not to blame. China Yahoo is controlled by Chinese firm Alibaba. Yahoo Inc. has a 40% stake in Alibaba. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Here's a sentence you've probably never heard before. There were parliamentary elections in Bhutan today. Yesterday, the tiny Himalayan country was an absolute monarchy. Today, it is the world's newest democracy. Bhutan's the place you might have heard where instead of gross domestic product, they measure gross national happiness. Economic reform actually came before today's big political change. Chances are there's going to be more of it, too, whether or not the Bhutanese know what they're in for. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli has visited Bhutan twice over the past year. A couple of weeks ago, she played host herself.
My friend Nawang had never seen the ocean.
Oh, I'm enjoying the beach. Yeah, it's hot.
Nawang's 23. Back in landlocked Bhutan, she's a DJ.
You're listening to Kuzu FM 105, the voice of the youth of Bhutan.
Nawang had never been to this country, so her vision of it came from movies and television, which were only allowed into Bhutan 9 years ago. She thought everyone here would look pretty much the same, tan and fit and rich. Even though I explained to her beforehand that I live in a one-bedroom apartment, she didn't really believe me. She had something a little more Hollywood in mind.
I thought that is like one of the movies which I have seen, Edward Scissorhands, where they have all the small plots of houses with all lawns and then the parking garage. And I thought that maybe you will have a maid to cook for you and all, but I was extremely wrong.
Not everyone in Bhutan has a maid or two or three like Nawang's family does. Most people in Bhutan couldn't afford a plane ticket to the United States. Since she lives with her parents and her family is well off, Nawang can live on her salary of $100 a month quite well. She uses most of it to pay for her cell phone. Here in America, Nawang was shocked at how much things cost. We're in a discount store looking at a package of socks for her niece.
How much is it?
$2.
$2 is 8 rupees. It is expensive for us.
Is it?
Nawang's view of the U.S. economy was as much a Hollywood fantasy as her take on my apartment. She figured everyone here made a U.S.-styled fortune and prices were the same as back in Bhutan. She thought she'd find work, maybe in an office, and cash in on that for a while. What she didn't get was the concept of the work visa.
Well, before I came here, I always had a concept of thinking that it's very easy to get the job out here. Like, we have these people going from Bhutan saying that they're going to work in the U.S. I always thought that they might be working in the offices. But when I came here, I came to know that they work as a babysitter, as a nanny.
After a few days, the reality and the homesickness hit. The fantasy of living here wore off, but the wonder of being in a new place had not. 1,000 times during her stay, she repeated,
"That's cool."
I took her to the largest Whole Foods in California. The quantity of food blew her mind. So did drive-thrus, vending machines, superhighways, the sheer variety of cars. They all amazed her.
A week ago, you hadn't seen the ocean, the traffic, the dishwasher, tall buildings.
And as tech-savvy as she is, the automatically flushing toilet at her office just about did her in.
It freaked me out, you know. I thought, I'll flush it. I got up, I put my zip up, and then it automatically went. I was scared for first time.
She adjusted to the toilets, but never to the pace of an American newsroom. Still, after coming to work with me for a week, she found herself catching marketplace fever.
When banks compete, you win.
Do you even know what that means?
Well, I don't know, but what I feel is like when the banks, when they are competing, you win.
But what, in Bhutan, there are only two banks, but do they compete with each other?
No. Because it's both government and no competitions.
In fact, that worried Nawang a bit, the idea that the government doesn't run the banks, but private companies do. She wondered how you could trust them. There are a lot of things that didn't make sense to Nawang about America, but one thing she came to understand is that there's no place like home.
If a friend of yours said, "You're crazy. Why did you were there? You didn't have to come back here." What would you say to them?
I'll tell them that, why don't you go and try yourself?
Sounds like democracy may come easy to Bhutan. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note to wrap things up on this Monday afternoon, the Justice Department has decided that combining the two existing satellite radio providers into one won't hurt consumers or competition. The DOJ approved the proposed $5 billion buyout of XM Satellite Radio by its chief rival, Sirius, today. It took the lawyers more than a year to agree on it. The Federal Communications Commission does still need to put its seal of approval on the deal. Nobody's really expecting anything different there. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow packed on 187 points, 1.5%. The NASDAQ rose 68 points, 3%. The S&P 500 added 20 points, 1.5%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, survival often trumps schooling for Iraqi refugees.
The future education prospects are down to next to nothing. And, of course, that's going to have a huge impact on what they can do once they reach adulthood.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.